Zaxby's Sensation Salad is so much more than a plain old salad. It's a salad. Which begs the question, at what point does a salad stop being a salad and become a salad? Is it when you add Zaxby's fried chicken to it? Crunchy wontons? Asian slaw? Citrus vinaigrette? Teriyaki glaze? Sweet and spicy sauce? Or is it when you top it all with a handmade perfectly fried egg roll? Without a doubt, the egg roll. The Sensation Salad. Only at Zaxby's.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, which is sponsored by The Nation magazine and widely available on all podcasting platforms. So this week, I want to take up the sort of debate that's coming out of the presidential election, especially on the side of the Democrats, and look at someone who's been a major voice, both in the last few years within internal debates in the Democratic Party, and now in the sort of aftermath. And I'm talking about Matt Iglesias. He's a longtime blogger and very prominent journalist, has published all over the place. I think his early association was with the American Prospect, but is now a very successful Substacker. Has written some very interesting books, including a sort of critique of the Democratic Party's foreign policy stance, and a book called 1 Billion Americans, arguing that in competition with China, the United States should have a much more open immigration policy and actually triple its population. So he's a very provocative, interesting thinker. I want to be as neutral as possible because I in certain circles, perhaps even inside Mr. Iglesias' head, I'm seen as a hostile critic. But I mean, he's a substantial figure, and I think he is offering a sort of critique that that has a certain resonance within the party, that the Biden presidency and the Harris campaign fail because the party has become too beholden to certain progressive factions. And that is actually a critique that to some degree, parts of I actually agree with, and other parts, as we'll find out, I perhaps have bigger disagreements with. But to talk about it, Matt Iglesias and his career and his current stance, I'm very happy to have on a frequent guest of the program, David Kleon. David, let's just sort of start with your general take on Iglesias as a figure, and then where he stands in these inter-party debates.
Yeah. So great to be here, first of all. Always good to talk, Jeet. So Iglesias, I've been reading Iglesias probably almost as long as he's been publishing. I mean, he's only a couple years older than me. I was reading him in college and beyond. I mean, through all the, American Prospect and Slate and Vox and all of it. There have been times when actually I agreed with a lot of things he had to say. And other times less so, and other times where I might not have fully agreed, but felt like at least I was getting some provocative challenges. Like you, I've been pretty irritated with his current pivot and his reaction, and not because I think it's wholly illegitimate. I want to give him his due, but let me just try to characterize that pivot first of all, and also to situate it. So obviously, we're a month out from a disastrous election, Trump beating Harris, winning every swing state, albeit by close margins. Everything is looking pretty bleak for governance in the U.S. for the next few years. Don't need to belabor that, but everyone's mad and everyone wants someone to blame. And one reason that I think things have become so fraught between, to simplify extremely, the left and the center right now, with Iglesias taking a more centrist position, and I think he would admit a more centrist position than he had even a few years ago, when he was a little more left identified. I think part of why it's become so fraught is because most everyone agrees that the main problem was Joe Biden and Joe Biden's administration and not Kamala Harris. There are reasonable critiques to be made of Kamala Harris and of her campaign, but even there, it comes down to, you know, Joe Biden picked her to be vice president. She was the logical successor.
And she basically ran a Joe Biden campaign.
She ran a Joe Biden campaign. She inherited.
Refused to, like, cut herself or make even do what Herbert Humphrey did in, like, 1968.
She didn't.
Making a distinction. And she also especially had, like, the same staff.
She inherited his top campaign staff.
And her campaign was run out of Wilmington, Delaware.
Yeah, all of which I roll my eyes at. And at the same time, it's like, well, Joe Biden gave them 3 months, you know.
Yes,
Biden put the country through this humiliating spectacle. Yeah. And clearly he should have said he wasn't going to run again 2 years earlier. I mean, everything comes back to Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting with what I think could be a point of unity. I think people across the entire political spectrum, if they're being remotely intellectually honest, would have to say Joe Biden is the source of our problems here.
Yeah. No, I mean, I want to be clear. Yeah, I think the original sin was Biden's decision to run again when he could have very reasonably, you know, said, like, I did what I had to do, defeated Donald Trump. It's time for a new generation of Democrats. They could have had a real primary, would have been listening to the voters more, and would have had a candidate, you know, more prepared to take on Donald Trump.
Very well, Kamala Harris, but even so, she would have been, you know, battled.
Yeah. But she would have been distinguished from Biden. She would have actually had to run, you know, if she ran in the primaries, would have been able, and would have had her own campaign team. I would actually argue. Maybe the original sin was running Biden in the first place.
Yeah.
Or of Obama choosing Biden as his vice president in 2008.
You could go back and question decisions.
Or Joe Biden being born. You know, like, these are all problems.
You could question decisions Jim Clyburn made in 2020. I mean, you can roll the clock back a lot. But I think for people who've been longtime Biden skeptics, who, let's say, were Biden skeptics during the 2020 primary.
Yeah.
And then, you know, maybe came around based on some things he did early in his administration. I think there is a certain degree of dark vindication here in that his presidency is a disaster. His, you know, what accomplishments he had will likely be rolled back. The Gaza thing is an eternal moral stain on him. His foreign policy in general is a bunch of kind of, you know, I mean, Ukraine, you could have at one point defended the policy, but where it's landing is pretty sad.
I think a good starting point is that Biden is a failed president.
He ran to defend democracy and defend our institutions, and he failed, right?
Yes.
Donald Trump is not going to jail. Donald Trump is back. The norms are out the window. It's a disaster. Mm-hmm. And it all comes back to Joe Biden and his administration. So I think the reason things are so fraught right now is because of the weird way that the Biden administration came together and operated, especially in its early years. Because Biden is clearly a centrist by temperament and record and history, and, you know, and codes as a centrist, and for all the obvious reasons going back over many decades, and no one would have said otherwise going into the 2020 primary. And at the same time, Biden brought in a lot of progressive staffers who were sympathetic to or had connections with Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, and built a lot of good working relationships with Sanders, with AOC, with essentially the most left wing of the party. And while that wasn't always appreciated by rank and file, you know, leftist activists and writers, it was by a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And especially in the first 2 years when Ron Klain was the chief of staff. And this creates a weird scenario where Biden is certainly not giving the left everything it wants, but he's giving it some things, and he's giving it some things that some prominent centrist voices would object to. Notably, for instance, you know, Larry Summers was constantly saying, if you do all these, you know, generous economic policies, it's going to cause rampant inflation, which will destroy your presidency. And people on the left rallied against Larry Summers, and we basically won that argument in the short term. But of course, inflation did turn out to be maybe the major albatross around Biden's neck, or around Harris's neck, as the case may be. So, so this creates a situation where it's not just economic policy. There are other areas where.
Sure.
Where Biden, I think, leaned left of what the party's most committed centrists would have wanted, to the point where it was very common for progressive commentators, including you and I at various times, to say over the last few years, Biden has been a surprisingly good president. He's done a lot of things we wanted him to do. Now, this creates...
Although I will just add a proviso that for me, That really ended after basically when Ron Klain left. But yeah. but even like a little bit before that, like by the spring of 2022, I felt that Biden was shifting from being New Deal president to being a wartime president.
Even to the extent I agree with that, which I basically do, it's not like, I mean, he had banked some accomplishments, right? He had
No. Correct. There were substantial accomplishments, and they continue to be good people in the White House. I would definitely say that he had like a more substantial domestic presidency than any Democrat since Lyndon Johnson.
It's a terrible risk right now. So
But like Lyndon Johnson, I mean, right. It's basically the Lyndon Johnson story again. It is great domestic accomplishments compromised by the logic of military Keynesianism, which entangles you in wars that destroy your presidency. But in any case, I do think that Biden does represent a dilemma to the left because he did give us
He gave us so much that we could credibly say, not that he gave us everything, not that we particularly liked him, but we could credibly say, you know what? Like, the party has turned a corner since the Clinton and Obama era. We've pulled it in a more left-wing direction through our advocacy and through the demonstrated success of Bernie Sanders as a challenger candidate in two elections. We've changed the conventional wisdom. We've, you know, beaten the deficit hawks. And we should feel good about that. We should take the win. But this, of course, creates an opening where when the whole thing crashes and burns, it's possible for someone like Matt Iglesias to pivot hard to the center, which he was already doing, but to pivot hard to the center and essentially vocalize a critique, which I will say, as he's pointed out in his recent response to you and on his Substack, you know, a critique that you can find through newsletters he wrote, you know, over the last several years. It's not all stuff he did yesterday, but essentially a critique that he's putting forward quite forcefully and that many influential Democrats are listening to. The gist of which, as I understand it, is the Democratic Party is too beholden to what they call the groups. And the groups, as caricatured by them, are basically a bunch of small advocacy organizations on a bunch of fronts, whether it's gun control, the environment, trans rights, anything, sort of a liberal immigration policy. The Democrats have become too beholden to these groups. The groups have too much influence over the kind of people who, for instance, staff legislative offices on Capitol Hill or staff the Biden White House. The groups do not have Democratic mandates. They are funded by, you know, progressive billionaires, basically. And yet they wield outsized influence. And what successful Democrats need to win elections is to tell them all to go to hell, reject their influence, pivot to the center on pretty much every topic except abortion. I saw at one point Iglesias tweeted a political cartoon he seemed to endorse that showed like a bus running over the various issues that had been thrown under the bus. And it was basically all of them except for abortion and like, I don't know, wages or something, maybe. Yeah. Like it was just like throwing out the entire progressive agenda with total abandon. And, you know, obviously this has created a lot of pushback for a few reasons. One is a queer person I know who's not particularly prominent, but did a tweet that's really sticking with me where he was weighing in on the left side of this debate, essentially. And he said, like, what do these guys want me to do, essentially? Do they want me to stop being gay? And I thought this was profound, actually, because not in a bleeding heart way, but the reality is, like, when they go, like, the groups, you can make some specific, you can name some specific funding sources, some specific donor networks, some specific organizations that have clearly fought with and pissed off Iglesias over the years and his friends. But more widely, the you know, the sort of assault on woke that's going on right now that Iglesias is very much buying into, and that's coming from, you know, every mainstream media source and many sitting Democrats. It's like, okay, I understand woke is unpopular. I understand there's a lot of polls showing woke, whatever, you know, as people understand it, is unpopular. I understand it alienates some people, and there are aspects of it that are excessive or that that are silly or you know, basically don't, you know, aren't very effective political communication, let's say. I actually concede all of that. But what it ultimately represents is a pluralistic coalition in a pluralistic country.
Yeah.
And while you can say, okay, well, these groups don't always speak and these advocates don't always speak for any individual group, I think modeling your party and its messaging on essentially trans people shouldn't feel welcome here, or to use a less maybe identitarian example, if you will, like, you know, Iglesias has argued that the Democrats moved left on gun control after Sandy Hook.
Yeah.
It's insane that they wouldn't, right? I mean, a bunch
I mean, literally the reason that they moved left, because like Obama had not been an anti-gun guy in any major way, was that the president had to go and meet the parents of, you know, like,
three-year-old children who massacred in a country where massacres of civilians happen routinely.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the availability of firearms. I don't need to rehearse this or convince anyone listening probably. Yeah. The only thing I want to say is, does Matt Iglesias think we can live in a country where, like him, when he saw the Uvalde shooting, people will see a massacre like that on TV and just think, eh, it's the price of being an American? Like, does he think that, like, I mean, some people do think that, but does he think that, like, tens of millions of people who have souls and see that aren't going to, like, demand that their elected officials do something? Does he think that, you know, that people who genuinely believe that we're in a climate emergency aren't going to, like, organize and agitate and bug their representatives? And maybe they'll be wrong about some things sometimes. But, like, I just don't understand what Iglesias's, like, practical strategy is for creating an America in which no one ever says anything that could be inconvenient to his favorite Democratic candidates.
Yeah, no, there's two things to say about that. One is, like, what is the mechanism by which one can get people to shut up who care about issues in a free democratic society, right? Like, you might not like, you know, pro-Palestine protesters or pro-trans activists, but how about in a free Palestine democratic society?
So many times, but people aren't going to shut up about Palestine because they authentically and I think correctly believe it's a genocide.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say there's
some people care about genocide.
Well, exactly, and I mean, I would say even more broadly. I mean, like, how you think about these things depends on whether you're thinking as a movement organizer or as a Democratic politician. Like, I think obviously from the point of view of if you're an elected Democrat, like, it's best for everyone to shut up as much as possible, and you can run on a kind of vacuous, you know, like, we're all human, I support the middle class agenda. But the fact is, in a democratic society, people do care about movements, and they care about the movements more than they care about parties. So one can look at something like, you know, John Kennedy did not like the civil rights movement, right? He found it incredibly disruptive. He wanted to be a Cold War president, and it was like, you know, like, bad for him that these sit-down protests were happening. But then he had to actually do it because this was like becoming an issue. And the polling would show, even back then, the civil rights movement, and particularly the protest methods that made it effective, the sort of sit-down protest movements, hugely unpopular, right? The same one could be said about ACT UP. Like, Democrats and Republicans at the time did not want to do anything about AIDS, and they would have been happy to let this issue just, like, be in the back burner. And the polling would show that, like, the radical stuff that ACT UP did of, you know, throwing blood at politicians was not popular. But actually, like, in terms of effective change within a democratic society, these sort of, like, disruptive protest movements, as unpopular as they are the only way to get to break any sort of gridlock or stalemate and to get issues heard. And unless you're willing to live in an authoritarian society, there's no way to actually stop people from doing this.
No, and when you talk about JFK and civil rights, or when you talk about Obama and gay marriage, for instance, you know, the issue that essentially became popular over the course of his presidency, and then was, you know, recognized judicially, but with you know, a fair bit of popular support, and with, you know, the president having previously said he was against it, which no one seriously believed, ushering it in. You know, in both of those cases and many others, there's a healthy dynamic that should obtain, I think, between liberal political parties and left-wing activists, mm-hmm. where essentially they have private conversations that amount to the liberal campaign saying, I agree with your guys' goals, more or less, and I would like you to succeed. You have to understand the political environment I'm operating in. Here are here's what the opposition party wants. Here's what some, you know, swing members of our party want. Here are some of my other priorities. I need to win re-election. If I don't win re-election, you get nothing. To which they say, okay, but I need to go back to the people I represent, and I need to tell them, you know, that the president is going to do something for them, right? He's not just going to blow them off and take them for granted. And there's, you know, this goes back and forth, and sometimes people strike the right balance and sometimes they don't, but that's the way it's supposed to work. What offends me about the way Iglesias is operating right now with his just like wholesale undisguised contempt for the groups, an incredibly sweeping phrase that seems to only mean left-wing groups and never means, you know, industry lobbyists, never means the Israel lobby, never means
crypto,
never. Yeah, right. We can get to that in a sec, but never means, you know, any small, you know, clique of people who try to manipulate things behind the scenes, which, you know, trust me, Iglesias has been enmeshed in as many such little cliques as any progressive he wants to criticize. So it's very one-sided, but it also, in that wholesale contempt, the message that it essentially sends to anyone who earnestly believes in any of these issues as mattering and considers them a matter of like morality or dignity is go away. We take you utterly for granted. We want you to feel bad. He's, you know, when Bill Clinton did the Sister Soldier thing, which is probably the model for how Iglesias is thinking right now, he Sister Soldier'd Sister Soldier. He picked one random performer at a thing who had said something that read ungenerously was, you know, let's kill white people. That wasn't what it actually was, but you know, that was certainly how one might read it. And he was picking on her to essentially signal, you know, at Jesse Jackson's event, which he was attending with Jesse Jackson, to essentially signal, look, there are limits where I am going to make known that I, the guy running to be president after 12 years of Republicans and racial backlash, you know, there are limits. White suburban moderates who are scared of crime or whatever can feel comfortable with me. Now, I don't want to defend that, but I want to say he picked a very, very specific scapegoat to sort of demonstrate this. Iglesias, as far as I can tell, is scapegoating all progressivism. He wants progressives to feel bad, feel unwelcome, feel like they have no seat at the table at all. Yeah. And my big, aside from the fact that I think that's immoral, that I share many of these priorities and that I think they're important, whether or not a poll shows they're popular at any given point. And, you know, I also think that just more strategically, I don't like, what percentage of the American electorate are like progressives, broadly defined? I mean,
this is perhaps another kind of key issue, because I actually think that for me, the big systematic problem with the Shore Iglesias analysis is that they are stuck in these political categories that no longer make sense to most people. Sure. If they ever did, I'm sort of like, you know, like liberal, conservative, moderate, progressive. I actually think that the big political divide in the United States in the Trump era is pro-system people and anti-system people.
That can get muddy very quickly because are a lot of people on both sides who have very, like, there are a lot of people who are clear-cut ideological conservatives, right?
They are. But I mean, Trump himself and the Republican Party of Trumpism has, like, you know, like, his conservatism now consists of hating the FBI and of wanting to make deals with Russia. Like it is actually...
That's true, but I think an awful lot of it is still basically down the line, you know, Republican priority issues.
But that's not how the Democrats ran against Trump. I mean, in any case, I do think that the number of people that are progressive, I wouldn't know the exact number, but it's definitely like a minority of Americans.
It's a minority, but
like 20%.
That was what I was going to say. 20%. Yeah. Let's call it 20%, give or take. Right. Okay. If 20% of Americans are broadly comfortable calling themselves progressives or liberals or leftists or some variation on that, and broadly support what you or I might recognize as, you know, the progressive agenda of a, of an AOC or whatever, give or take. You know, that's clearly a minority and clearly can't just run the country on its own. But how exactly do you build a winning Democratic Party that doesn't make that very large swath of the country feel like it is, you know, represented in some way and has some role? Like, you have to build a big tent. And I think the essence of what Iglesias is saying is, we've made the tent too big. We've let in too many people who annoy me, and we need to tell them to go. And I just think, like, the system is, like, there are laws of gravity here. You can't, if you reduce the Democratic Party, as he seems to be proposing, to a sort of economically moderate, let's not further restrict abortion than it's already been restricted party, with some like technocratic solutions that that only like a very narrow class of people understand at all, and with a political class that avoids any and all populist rhetoric, avoids, you know, identifying enemies in private equity or crypto or Wall Street or anywhere. You know, what that party will only win when Republicans are in power and are screwing up, which of course will happen most likely.
Which I mean, basically is the case now. Like, they win half the time because people want to throw the bums out. But there's two things I'll say. Like, within the Democrat, I mean,
that party is basically to like give America a breather after the right has pulled us dramatically in their direction.
And I
know so many people who, if it were that blunt, if it were exactly what I just described, would just stop voting for Democrats. They'd just be
I actually think that a lot of people, that's what this last election was about, because Kamala Harris got 7 million more or less votes less than Biden did. But there's two things. One is that in a primary system, if you had a candidate that ran on that, we would know what would happen to them, because there have been people who have basically run on that, right? That's kind of like the sort of, you know, Bloomberg, Michael Bennett. Even Bloomberg's a little bit more progressive.
Bloomberg at least believes in gun control. He believes in, you know,
climate action.
Soda cup small. He believes in, you know, he's a climate hawk. I mean,
But there have been people like I think there are centrist Democrats. I mean, I think in 2016, Iglesias supported O'Malley. You know, O'Malley would have won, and I mean, so that position, that space, does actually exist, and it has not been very successful in presidential primaries, and even Joe Biden, who kind of occupied that space, like, you know, emotionally, knew that he had to offer more to govern in the Democratic Party of today. So we basically know. I mean, that is part of the Democratic Party coalition, but it's a small part, and
knowing what I know about Iglesias and his circles, I suspect they would also be in favor of a less small D democratic primary process in which
party insiders
who agree with them would essentially get to pick all the candidates.
The other thing I will say is, like, yeah, I mean, that part of politics exists, and, you know, like, has had a smaller part, but to the extent that it exists also, that, I mean, these were the people who were guiding the Harris campaign, right? Like Harris ran a much more conservative campaign than Joe Biden. She was asked, like, how she'd be different than Biden. And she first said, well, I wouldn't be different in any way. And then she said, oh, no, actually, there's one difference. I'll appoint a Republican to the cabinet.
Right.
And then she, you know, like, she ran a campaign where she, you know, appointed a Republican to the cabinet, campaigned with not just Liz Cheney, but welcomed the support of Dick Cheney. And Alberto Gonzalez, like, she actually cited Alberto Gonzalez as one of her supporters. As some listeners will remember, the author of the torture memo under George W. Bush. She said she owned a Glock and, you know, would use it if necessary. And crucially, she took a lot of Wall Street money and, as the New York Times has reported in great detail, let Wall Street people, especially her brother-in-law, Tony West, who's an Uber executive, basically shape her economic message.
Yeah.
And in particular, on the issue of inflation, what the Democrats found from polling, if one wants to go by the data and polling people, is that the polling showed that going after price gouging was very popular, and especially if you named specific corporations as guilty of price gouging.
Right.
And when she like tried to make that message, she got these emails from the Wall Street backers, you got to tone this down, and they definitely toned it down. So if one is talking about like the actual structure of the Democratic Party and the actual campaign that was run, it was and I have that Iglesias is
from David. Do you know what I honestly
David
believe?
David Shore ran a super PAC that had $950 million in funding, like nearly $1 billion of super PAC funding to carry out basically this kind of populist Shoreite, Iglesiasite a vision. So, I mean, they ran the campaign they wanted.
So I think, their rebuttal to that would probably be, look, all the progressive stuff was baked in the first 2 years, and she was stuck with Biden's record running against powerful headwinds. And I think, the powerful headwinds part and the she's stuck with Biden's record is probably more or less true. But one thing that I
doubt. I don't want to concede those points. I don't want to concede those points because there's two things. One of which is that we know from the record that after the spring of 2022, Biden shifted rhetorically and like started to de-emphasize Build Back Better and infrastructure spending. And like rhetorically, his presidency really became about defending democracy globally, the war in Ukraine, China, and then eventually Israel, towards a type of austerity where Biden continually started talking more about cutting the deficit. And this was his sort of rhetorical profile. And then the campaign that she ran. What they're basically doing is rewriting the history of the last 2 years of the Biden presidency, where its public face was not like an economically progressive public face, but was much more conservative, and particularly the Harris campaign.
I largely agree with you. The only caveat I would make to that is that I think inflation, even though, the wonks I know would be like, well, they got inflation under control. They beat inflation. Here's a chart that shows that. But I think to the average voter, inflation means prices went up steeply a few years ago and they haven't gone back. And I'm mad about it. And
No. Inflation absolutely hurt them, but they did not use the political weapon that they had against inflation.
They didn't form an enemy. Unlike Barack Obama, it wasn't inflation, but unlike Barack Obama running for re-election in 2012, where having overseen 4 years of economic misery because, the recession started right before he took office, and having, to own that, he essentially ran a, some people thought a kind of phony, but whatever, it worked, a populist campaign against the Mitt Romney private equity sector, and it worked.
Obama ran with the message, which was a true message, that Mitt Romney is this super wealthy guy that made money deindustrializing the Midwest. Yeah. He's a vulture capitalist.
Guys, and this is this the reason you lost your home, not guys like me.
Yeah.
An effective message.
A true message. And a true message against Donald Trump would be that he's a plutocrat who's a friend of plutocrats. But this is not how the Democrats ran in 2016.
It's not what Mark Cuban wants to hear.
Yeah, well, this in 2016, Hillary said, he's not a real billionaire. Right. And the real billionaires like Michael Bloomberg support us. And in 2024, the surrogate for the Harris campaign, one of the major surrogates, did they have any trans surrogates? Did they have any Palestinian surrogates? Did they have any real economic populist surrogates other than like Bernie, who they kept an arm's length from? No, their surrogate was Mark Cuban, a former Republican billionaire who repeatedly told the public that any economic populism that the Harris campaign, that the Biden administration had, is no longer on the table. He said, this is no longer the Democratic Party of old. This is Kamala Harris's Democratic Party. I just think like that was the actual message by the campaign through one of their major surrogates. I just think like I think it's a real mistake. All this talk about headwinds and we're burdened.
Headwinds do have some historical precedent, but important one is that no one had ever been more unpopular at any point in the cycle for at least, I don't know, 2 years or so before than Joe Biden. And that predicts pretty much flawlessly which party is going to win, replacing a smart idea that probably protected down ballot races. But I will concede.
Just on that last point about Cuban, I would just want to quote something Cuban said, like on cable television. People are trying to say, here are the progressive and liberal principles that have always been the principles of the Democratic Party. Those are gone. It's Kamala Harris's party now. Surrogate is saying that we're no longer progressive and liberal, but on the headwind of, yes, Biden was the major headwind. Hugely unpopular president. She could have broken with Biden on a bunch of these issues. She could have said...
There's also, Jade, I just want to say, I want to make sure we get this in here. There's a thing that people largely dance around, but I think is does weigh on this entire debate, which is just, I'll say it as bluntly as possible. I think a lot, and I'm not specifically accusing Matt Iglesias of this, just for the record, but I think a lot of Harris's critics also don't want to say out loud, but basically think, you know what? We ran a black woman from California with a sort of exotic sounding name. And that is just automatically woke coded. And it doesn't really, you know, that's why she had to do all those things. Of course, they probably think that she should have anyway. But, you know, what they will say that kind of hints at this is when they say, oh, we should have had an open primary. We should have had the Ezra Klein, you know, make it up on the spot primary that only party insiders get to participate in. And then they'll list a bunch of people. And sometimes they'll say Gretchen Whitmer. But basically, they list a bunch of white guys.
If the argument is
Biden
that if you have the context of a racist and sexist society, if you're running like a woman or especially a woman of color, they have to run more conservative. There's some basic truth that, although I will also say that, you know,
well, I think
Barack Hussein Obama won the presidency twice.
Right. I mean, this is where they'll say sexism is more powerful than racism. But
yeah, yeah. Well, they, okay, you know, beyond that, I mean,
I do think Obama kind of gives the lie to the idea that there, but you could,
yeah,
you
but, argue, but
you could argue he had to be exceptionally talented at politics, which he was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I mean, if your argument is that we should be running like very charismatic candidates, you know, like I actually support that. And
I think your argument is that we should run a white male Jewish guy named Josh Shapiro who does
an extremely
hokey impression of Barack Obama.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's just ludicrous. Yeah. But yeah. I think one can't discount, you know, like the influence of sexism and of racism, but I mean that still does not explain like why Kamala Harris ran the kind of campaign that she did. And I want to say the other point is that yes, she was burdened by Biden, but that burden was, you know, like partially a matter of choice that she chose to run as Biden-esque a campaign as possible.
Yeah, she would have had a very hard time getting out of that cage, though, especially because she's a small C conservative temperamentally. Like, she's not a risk taker. She's not a very creative politician, I would say.
Well, yeah, but also the fact that she was surrounded by Biden people. But then if the original sin is Biden running again and Biden, you know, like being too old and unpopular, you know, like then I have to say, like, you know, like the, you know, Iglesias, like he contests this, but like, you know, he was very tight with the Biden administration. You know, he got to, you know, like he was, his Substack was widely read there. He got to, you know, meet the president. I think a lot of the sort of turn of the Biden administration away from a forward facing progressive voice towards more moderate rhetoric. And then the role that Shore played in, you know, running a $950 million super PAC. I mean, they were all tied with that. And like, you know, like Iglesias' position was that, like, you know, like he met with Biden and he seemed sharp. And that, you know, like Iglesias only, you know, turned against him at the last possible minute. Now, I have to say, like, there were a lot of people, you know, like, not just progressive, people who are like really on the far left, the sort of dirtbag left, who were saying from 2020, you know, like, Joe Biden seems really old and like really not the same man he was. And I'll say, like, I've talked to Democratic politicians off the record, and this is what they were saying in 2020.
Everybody.
So I don't think it was everybody knew. This is so
you consolidated around.
Yeah. But I mean, like, Iglesias with it, you know, like, and not him alone, but there was an entire infrastructure of liberal and centrist journalists who were like, you know, wanted people to turn a blind eye. And I'll say, like, you know, some on the left were guilty of this, especially politicians like Bernie Sanders and AOC. Sure, but so it's a widespread kind of party problem, but that was the problem, right? And like, if you're talking about like why Democrats are unpopular and why the party lost, like the fact that people were like basically lying for the last like, you know, 4 years about the health of the president. And then also, I mean, like,
including Kamala Harris, by the way.
But I mean, they did this to themselves.
Yeah.
And that is not like, you know, like these, you know, it's not these progressive interns at like nonprofits that did this. This is like a decision of the party at the highest level.
Yeah.
Basically, because I think that they decided Joe Biden, as old as he is the only one who could beat Bernie. So we have to have Biden, right?
Right. I mean, one of the infuriating phenomena of the last month has been a number of mainstream figures, people like David Brooks, or I think maybe David Axelrod said this, or saying essentially, you know, Bernie 2016 was making some really good points. And as a veteran of the Bernie 2016 wars, I don't think I can say on this family-friendly podcast how mad that makes me. Like, it just like, yeah, no shit, basically. Like, yeah. You had a guy who was promising a populist, you know, working class. He wasn't anti-woke, but he did not foreground wokeness. It wasn't his main message.
Which is the right stance to take.
Democratic establishment, chair-led by people like Matt Iglesias and Ezra Klein, you know, and Dylan Matthews at Vox, who you know, ran pieces attacking Bernie for being too conservative on immigration, for being too conservative, I think, on guns, for just amorphously being sexist because you know, some...
He ran against Hillary, yes.
Because some feminist allies of Hillary Clinton insisted he was, so it had to be true.
And the whole idea of Bernie Bros was a kind of creation of this centrist liberal clique.
Anyone on the left who was there for Bernie, championing Bernie through that, and has a functioning memory, understands... We tried to nominate the kind of candidate, except with the critical difference that, unlike Matt Iglesias' favorite candidates, he would tell Americans that Wall Street was the enemy. He would tell Americans that concentrated wealth was the enemy, when you're supposed to essentially just run Mitt Romney's campaign, I guess. Iglesias having once voted for Mitt Romney for governor of Massachusetts.
No. I mean, there is an interesting point that, like...
And we saw wokeness very cynically deployed to destroy a genuine progressive, who I think, on the record, in many ways, was woker than Hillary Clinton was.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, the classic line that everyone now quotes is Hillary Clinton saying that, you know, breaking up the banks won't end racism. And it is absolutely the case that identity politics and wokeism was elevated from being a kind of niche thing that existed in academia and in certain progressive spaces to getting a central position in national politics by the Hillary Clinton campaign.
Yes.
Iglesias
supporting it. And now they've done a really... You know, there is significant overlap in, for instance, a figure like AOC. There are plenty of people who I would say have broadly woke cultural politics, also broadly like left progressive economic politics. But these are not synonymous things. And there are plenty of people who are one of those things, but not the other. And there have been plenty of lively debates across the left for years over which of those is more important. Are they at odds with each other? And I've noticed that Iglesias and his crew right now seem to be attacking them indiscriminately. They are, all the left, it's all the groups, and it's all bad. So, like, yes, they hate the, like, people who want, you know, pronouns in bios or whatever, but they also, or who want any kind of gun control, but then they also want, they also hate, like, you know, Matt Stollerite, like, anti-monopoly stuff, when Matt Stoller is, like, the least woke person imaginable. It's just, like, they hate it all. They hate
everything. Yeah, no. It's absolutely the case. And so, I mean, basically, well, okay, the true part of Shorism actually comes out of Bernie. And there is a way in which I think Shor at a particular time identified himself as a democratic socialist. But there is a kind of, like, you know, Bernie-style economic reductionism, which says, you know, the key issue is the 1% versus everyone else. We rally behind that. And that will give us a majority we need. And then we can also be in a position to deal with these social issues in the way that we want. And I basically agree with that. I mean, Bernie's position is like, you know, if you're running in Nebraska or elsewhere, like, you know, you can come out against gun control. You can even be socially conservative on abortion. I think the Osborne campaign in Nebraska, which, you know, greatly overperformed Harris, is a good example of how this could be done.
Right.
And like, I see.
Meanwhile, AOC outperformed Harris, right?
Yeah, different
areas have different needs, but.
Yeah. No. So that's all to the good. And I've never been an identity politics person, like, at all.
You signed the Harper's letter. You signed the Harper's letter.
I signed the Harper's letter. Yeah. I just think, like, there's a question of, like, do you, like, downplay identity politics because you don't think that should be the central part of politics, or you downplay it because you don't like the people who are involved with identity politics, which I think the second thing,
very obviously doesn't.
They're
often mean to him online. I wanted to bring up one bit of anecdata about Iglesias that I actually think might speak to some of his incentives right now, though I want to be clear, I'm just spitballing here. I don't know if you saw the progressive journalist Andrew Perez yesterday had a tweet about Iglesias where it was like two screenshots, and one of them showed, you know, how much money Iglesias makes from his Substack, which is well over $1 million a year. Which is an insane amount of money to make.
And yeah, sure.
Congrats, we should all be so lucky. But the other screenshot was Iglesias had tweeted his delivery receipt from having Shake Shack delivered to his home. Now, I'm not going to judge having Shake Shack delivered to your home, but that's fine. I'm not here to hate on that. What I will say is the receipt is there, and he had some like complaint in it to the effect that, like, you know, it was an expensive meal, though it was hard to see how the food was itemized, but it came out to like, I don't know, $27. I don't know.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, Trumpflation, as he's calling it, all, you know, which is already very loaded, you know, has come for me. But I don't see how like kicking out the immigrant delivery guy from the country is going to make this meal any cheaper, which, okay, I agree with that as far as it goes. It is not going to make it cheaper. However, well, first of all, Iglesias has been all over the place on immigration, but not even getting into that. His receipt included his tip, and he gave a 10% tip on this bill. A 10% tip is an egregiously stingy tip, and many, many, many people were dragging him on Twitter for this, which, you know, you or I or lots of people might look at that and think, wow, you don't tip 20% to the immigrant delivery guy who I'm sure is already making sub-minimum wage and lives, you know, like could be deported. And I mean, you're already cheating him so that you can get your home delivery burger. And, you know, is Iglesias so clueless that he thinks that's a good tip? But I thought about it a little more and I thought, you know what? It's kind of a famous truism that very rich people tip poorly. Not always, but often.
I've seen that in my own life. I have seen
middle class people who have ever worked service jobs. Yeah. You know, that's pretty well known. And I was thinking the people who pay Iglesias $10 million a year for his Substack collectively are not a representative swath of middle America, right?
Yeah.
They are, I'm sure, with scattered exceptions, very well educated, very affluent. Mm-hmm. Professional class people. Now that's
Again,
I don't, you know, that's most people.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole irony of all this. The market for this is the PMC.
Oh yeah. I mean, Iglesias is a child of the PMC. He spent He spent his whole life in PMC institutions. So have I. Yeah. Like I'm not trying to like bully him for that per se. Yeah.
I'm not a child of the PMC, so I will bully him for that.
You can bully him. All I'm saying is tip your delivery guy 20%. Yeah. And you know, if he's advertising that he doesn't, it's possible he's just really clueless. But it's also possible that in a weird way, this and the inevitable backlash it generates of people yelling at him that he's stingy actually is a, like a way of signaling to his readership, like, I'm just like you. You know, I'm a rich jerk just like you. I'm better than this. The whiny left yells at me. They call me a bad person. But that's just because I have the guts to tell the truth, you know?
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's probably a little bit of, I certainly think a lot of his sort of more provocative tweets, which I really should not respond to because it sort of feeds into his marketing strategy. But they are kind of designed to polarize and get the kind of results that you described. It is a kind of way of getting attention. And it's, good on him. It's been very successful. I will sort of maybe step back a little bit and think, obviously, he has a certain sort of class origin. I don't want to lean too much into class identity stuff, except to note that, my dad drove a cab and my mom cleaned hospital linen all her life. And Iglesias, the child of a very well-to-do screenwriter and editor for Newsweek, who went to Dalton and Harvard, has a kind of different background. But I would say in terms of that class, though, I want to maybe depersonalize it, whether he's cheap or not. There is a particular.
Yeah, because I'll just interject that there are certainly working class people who, just voted for Donald Trump. And
oh, sure. Which actually,
people who are, democratic socialists. It doesn't have.
Listen, I know working class Indians here of my own family who, if Trump were running, would support him.
Right.
Because he's anti-system, because he is I totally understand where that's coming from. And it is if you've been screwed by the system your whole life, then a politician.
Yeah, but I'm going to be a little less generous in at least some cases and say that, a lot of them are essentially petty bourgeois shop owners who.
Yeah. No, there's that. It's a grand.
They want and don't feel any solidarity with working people at all. And I've known plenty of PMC or wealthy people who sincerely want a more. I'm not trying to be not all rich people.
There's complexities in all these sort of class formations.
I'm not doing it really offended, but because I think that in analytically we should understand that there's a class de-alignment going on right now, and that in reality, the big divider between Democrats and Republicans these days is probably a college degree, which correlates to a certain amount with class, but not 100%, and can create scenarios where a starving adjunct with working class parents is very left wing, but a blue collar non-college worker who makes, six figures and has a big house is very right leaning. And those are both common archetypes. Because unfortunately, the parties, you can judge their tax plans however you want, but in terms of who they try to appeal to, it is not as simple as the haves versus the have-nots.
No. I think it is. There's some within that class de-alignment. There is the broader phenomenon of system versus anti-system. I think for a variety of reasons, people who don't have a college education are more attracted towards the style of anti-system politics and towards the style of a politician who says, screw you to establish rules and norms. And within that context, I do want to say do a sort of depersonalized and not even hostile sort of portrait of that sort of, the class identity that someone like Iglesias has, which is not just PMC, but specifically there's a type of intellectual that has existed in America, according to Christopher Lash, since the late 19th, early 20th century, which is these people coming out of elite institutions like Harvard, gravitating towards a kind of technocratic politics that sees solution in expertise and also want to depoliticize society or keep mass political action away from politics. The archetype of all this is Walter Lippmann, starting in the early 20th century.
Right.
But again, his common trajectory had started as a socialist, but his socialism was became a kind of technocratic politics, a liberal technocratic politics, a politics of expertise, of there's a certain class of pundits who know best, and that the sort of mass political action of things like unions or protest movements is best kept away from politics because of the irrationality of the masses. Right. Now, this Walter Lippmann prototype, you know, and then the New Republic magazine, which Lippmann was one of the founders of, really became the archetype of that type of thinking, has been a strain in American politics, you know, from that period. And one sees it popping up again and again in times like the Adelaide Stevenson campaign, the Cold War liberalism, and then later in sort of like Marty Peretz style neoliberalism of the 80s and 90s. And so I think that that is, you know, the intellectual and class tradition that Iglesias comes out of. It's actually, you know, like, it's ridiculous how many of these guys come from Harvard. It is basically the politics of Harvard alumni who go into journalism and punditry. I will say, on behalf of this politics, like, you know, like, some often produces good writing, you know, has to be taken seriously, but is also like, you know, like a politics that feeds into the sort of class de-alignment. Because if these are the voices of your party, these kind of technocratic guys who know how to read charts and who are YIMBYs and whatnot, you know, you're not really gonna have like anything to offer the working class. You're not gonna have that type of Bernie anger and the naming of the system, which is the one thing that can really draw anti-system, non-college educated people towards a center-left party. So in that sense, I think that Iglesias' class alignment and class politics is at odds with what is actually the good part of his message, which is the Democrats should not be a party just of the college educated,
right?
It, you know, needs to have a greater diversity of voices. But I mean, like, but I'm sorry, but Matt Iglesias and, you know, of Dalton and Harvard and David Shore, you know, whatever universities he went to, these guys are like, you know, like to the average American, to certainly like the taxi cab drivers in my family, these guys are just like liberal nerds, you know, like.
Well, to be fair, they're not the ones on the top of the ticket, but
sure, they have the ears of the people on the top of the ticket.
Yeah, they certainly do, and they
Shore ran like a $950 million super PAC. I mean, like, let's not pretend that these are not people with power and influence within the party.
Oh, no, I would never. I would never. Yeah. No, I just think that it's interesting that he intuits, as almost everyone does in their own way, that we're having this anti-systemic moment and this backlash against, you know, the established power structures, but he seems to locate those mainly in, you know, campus speech codes designed to help different kinds of people get along on a more diverse campus environment, which are, you know, which can be annoying at times, but are, and which apparently do annoy lots of Americans who never set foot on college campuses, but per polling. But I am
but again, the salience of these issues. I mean, this is the thing. Like, this is where I do feel like Shore and Iglesias abuse their, you know, what I think is a kind of pretend authority of expertise in polling. And that, sure, you can show polling that says these things are unpopular, but it's also very clear from both polling and election results, these are not salient issues. The salient issues were inflation and immigration, and I have to say, foreign policy. That is one issue where Trump, like,
On foreign policy specifically, I mean, I basically spent the last year of Biden's presidency, the main issue I was engaged on was what he was doing to Gaza. And I feel morally fervent about that. I feel more so with each passing month.
Yeah,
I think Biden and the Democrats disgraced themselves on this. I think a huge number of aligned pundits disgraced themselves on this. And one of them is Matt Iglesias, who, you know, I remember many years ago, like, went to Hebron.
Hebron. Yeah. No.
Israeli apartheid up close, and had the reaction many intellectually honest journalists, including Ta-Nehisi Coates more recently, have had.
Yeah, or me. I mean, that was my reaction when I went to the West Bank. It's like,
yeah, they see
how the hell is this allowed?
It's apartheid, and I must oppose it. Yeah. So I know he knows that, and I don't even think he is a particularly fervent Zionist.
Yeah.
But his habit of mind at this point of essentially left-wing groups are protesting and complaining about something, therefore it must be frivolous and stupid and should be shut down, absolutely extended to how he reacted to the events after October 7th. And so I found him to be utterly glib, utterly smug, contemptuous of anyone who was tired of seeing, you know, like mangled babies on their screen every day, you know, because of U.S. foreign policy, you know, gaslighting us because that was what the administration was doing and he was aligned with the administration. And I get the sense, not even because he's like a true believer, right? It's not because he really believes this policy. It's because he understands, you know, that he derives authority from his relationship with Biden. So he's going to go ahead and whitewash a genocide, and it's not going to trouble him too much because he doesn't seem to have very many deeply held core beliefs.
Just a little one step, a little bit more cynical than that, which is that if you look at the sort of funding of like Shor and those groups and their political alignment, there's like money, A, from crypto, you know, which Iglesias' defenses of Sam Bankman-Fried kind of play.
Yeah, we would be remiss if we didn't note that two years ago, Matt Iglesias was perhaps the single most prominent and vocal defender of the good character and intentions of world historical scamster Sam Bankman-Fried, who's now serving a 25-year sentence. But the
other major funder of this popularist project, the one who's like sort of the groups that are, you know, helping fund the sort of centrist is sort of like AIPAC, Democratic Majority for Israel, and they have like worked very closely with these centrists in places like New York City and elsewhere.
Well,
so
right.
I don't think Richie it's an accident.
Richie Torres.
And again, like I want to emphasize, to me, they got the campaign they wanted because, you know, like a sort of campaign that was too beholden to progressive groups would have allowed a Palestinian to speak at the DNC or would have made some gesture towards the Palestinian concerns.
I basically stopped trying to persuade people who care deeply about Palestine.
But not only did they not persuade people, they actually did their own sister soldier moment. They actually sent first Richie Torres to Michigan, and then they also sent Bill Clinton, you know, a man who's associated with NAFTA, which is not popular in Michigan. They sent him to Michigan, where he blamed sort of, you know, like Palestinians for the civilian casualties since October 7th, and justified Israel's position in the region and Israel's claims by citing King David in the Bible and Judea and Samaria.
Yeah, that was a truly low moment. And you know, like you can't blame the whole loss on Palestine, but the evidence that it did real damage does exist. And I would just say that I was saying loudly and publicly, like within weeks of the war starting online, that, you know, this could really hurt Democrats in a number of places, but especially Michigan. And I distinctly remember Matt Iglesias calling me and I think our mutual friend Matt Duss out, because he was, you know, retweeting me or whatever. I think Iglesias was calling us out and saying, you know, essentially like, well, you know, you have biased views on this topic, so like, why should anyone trust your analysis of the electorate? And it's just like, I'm sorry, like, why should anyone trust your analysis of the electorate? You're the guy who thought Sam Bankman-Fried was going to be good for the political causes you backed,
and that Joe Biden was politically sharp. I'll add on this issue of like the influence of Palestine, and I think more broadly the anti-war stuff. The New York Times has reported that the Trump campaign, their own polling showed that voters who were undecided were six times more likely to be concerned about Biden's Gaza stance, and were very concerned of all the wars that are going on. And if you look at the Trump
and Musk campaigned on this. They campaigned on Harris has aligned herself with Liz Cheney and the neocons, and Harris is killing Muslims. Now, you can say that's utterly cynical of them. Yeah. You can say that what they're actually going to do is accelerate Israel's genocide, which I believe and said myself. But as a political matter, I don't know how you get around the fact that that they saw an opening there and they exploited it. And there's some evidence that it worked.
Yeah, no, it worked both times. The same thing happened in 2016, where the Hillary Clinton attacked Trump from the right on war stuff. And if you look at Trump's campaign stuff, all along the last few weeks of the election, it was a lot of his anti-war. Again, not to say that he was honest, not to say this was not cynical. But the other thing I would emphasize is, like, Joe Biden thought that being his foreign policy was a great strength. And he would talk to congressmen off the record and say, like, why isn't, aren't you talking about what a great foreign policy president I am, how I strengthened NATO, how I strengthened, was it ACUS? Just as a matter of political analysis, we know that Biden's foreign policy was unpopular. But even beyond that, in terms of, like, feeding into the broader thing, I think that there were a lot of Americans who, whatever stance they take, did not want a president that's so concerned with foreign policy, that is really making that so central to his presidency. They really believe that American domestic policy, American domestic reform came first. And so if I were like a real, if the populists were genuine, if people like Shore and Iglesias wanted to do a genuine, like, intellectually honest analysis, they would have to look at the fact that, you know, Joe Biden's commitment to being like a new Cold War president, to being a new Harry Truman, actually being a new Lyndon Johnson in a lot of ways, was like deeply damaging to the Democratic coalition, and it absolutely hurt him, and that they have to think about, like, you know, like how Democrats have to get in alignment with the public mood, which since, like, basically the Iraq war turned bad, since the insurgency ramped up in 2005, the American public has been weary of war and has wanted an inward turn of prioritizing domestic reform. So, like, an intellectually honest populist position would, like, think about that, but they don't, because I don't think it's an intellectually honest position. I think that they're mainly concerned about getting money from Democratic, big money Democratic donors, and calibrating a politics that suits that class.
Yeah, well, I think I feel we can probably wrap up there, but I feel confident that they will find their lane, as Iglesias certainly has always managed to do for the last 20 years.
Yeah, no. They will continue to be successful. But I mean, I realize that this is like a very sort of like harsh judgment, but it's said like not without some analysis, and I would really like to see them address like these problems. But in any case, thank you once again to David Cleon for being on the program for this very lively discussion.
Always a pleasure.